It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. In the online world, it can feel like privacy is a lost cause. Technology companies find out a lot about us. Everything from our health data to dating site info to private messages with romantic partners aren't entirely our own. And there's a growing problem with non-consensual pornography, with our most private moments captured, posted online, used sometimes for extortion, humiliation, and abuse. Our next guest says we have yet to grasp the scale of that invasion of our intimate privacy and that U.S. law often fails to keep up. She calls for elevating that privacy as a fundamental right and turning to civil rights law as a way to give us back control over our own information. Danielle Citrin is a distinguished professor of law at the University of Virginia, where she teaches about privacy, free expression, and civil rights. She's director of the university's Law Tech Center. Her newest book is The Fight for Privacy, Protecting Dignity, Identity, and Love in the Digital Age. It's out next week, available now for pre-order. Danielle, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me back.
The book centers around this concept of intimate privacy. What do you mean by that?
So it's the privacy, it's information and access to our bodies, our health, our innermost thoughts, which of course we don't realize, but we document all day long on our, you know, our reading, our browsing, our searching, all of our digital communications, and then our closest relationships.
We, I think, sometimes accept a loss of privacy as the price of entry into the online world. Does it have to be that way?
It doesn't have to be, and it shouldn't be. You know, we, you know, go to the restroom and use hotel, you know, bedrooms and bathrooms, and we kind of all the while we expect and we deserve privacy around our, you know, our bodies and our, you know, our physical selves. And the same is true when we, you know, use search engines to figure out medicines that we want to take, or we look and we read on WebMD about our health conditions. At the same time, we are expecting privacy and we deserve privacy, but so often we don't get it.
You just mentioned a couple of the main categories you focus on in your book. I want to start with that second one, the information that gets accumulated on us when we use reward points at a pharmacy or do a medical search or participate in a dating site. You talk about when people go and get information that's collected by these data companies we haven't heard of. Can you talk about how extensive a dossier exists, probably about each and every one of us at this point?
Oh, yeah. So I would say that there are about 10,000 data brokers, and about 98% of all Americans have dossiers held by these companies, and they have over 10,000 data points on each and every one of us. Now, you might say to me, like, how is that possible? I'm not that interesting. But what is, you know, everything that we do and all the traces of our online lives, whether it's the, you know, our activities on our dating and our health apps, our searches, our location, where we're going, tells us a story about, you know, we're ranked and rated and scored. Have we ever been a rape victim? Have we ever had terminated a pregnancy, had a miscarriage? Have we ever had, you know, high blood pressure? What's our risk of getting a chronic disease, like, let's say, type 1 diabetes or type 2 diabetes? And so data brokers have data points that suggest so many different aspects of our lives, our sexual orientation, our deepest interest, whether we're sex toy users, how often we use adult sites. The list goes on and on. I'm just trying to give some, sure, you know, some examples, right, of just how invasive, how much of a story data broker dossiers tell about us in ways that we would never kind of expect and in ways that we have no control over.
Okay, now we worry sometimes about a data breach, right? All that stuff falling into the wrong hands illegally. Set that aside. Who are the customers for this data? What are people legally doing with these massive troves of data about all of us?
Some of the biggest clients of data brokers are law enforcement. So state, federal, and local law enforcement. Using it to detect all crimes, all hazards, and all risks. And of course, not just law enforcement, but employers, life insurance companies, hiring services. There are third-party hiring services that detect, you know, that sort of run their algorithms through vast databases of resumes. Those hiring services, so not the employers themselves, are making recommendations to employers about the people to hire. So it's, you know, you name the industry, besides advertisers and marketers, they're buying those data broker dossiers.
What kind of legal changes would you like to see, or maybe changes in the way companies do business that give us, I don't know, more say, more control over where all that data gets used?
So I want to move us away from the notion that sort of control is the answer, and for us to understand intimate information in our intimate lives as implicating, you know, a moral right, a fundamental human right and civil right, which would mean that rather than kind of leaving it up to individuals and consumers to make choices, which at scale we really can't do, it's really hard with, you know, the 10,000 data brokers are just the tip of the iceberg of the extent to which our information is being collected, you know, used and sold. And so if we understood intimate privacy as a civil right, that would sort of, right now our presumption is that you can collect anything you want, you can share it, and you can use it so long as you have some warning in your privacy policy that frankly no one reads, you know, in the bottom of your web page. I'd like us to flip that presumption. If we understood our intimate data as implicating our civil rights, that is the rights that all of us enjoy and have important structural protections against discrimination, what that would mean is that when a powerful entity has power over our civil rights, it means that that entity is understood as the caretaker of those rights. They are the stewards of those rights. And so you can't, if you understand intimate privacy as implicating our civil rights, it would mean that anyone, individuals, companies, governments, interacting with our intimate information would have to be the guardians of that data. And some of the time that would mean you can't collect it. You can't collect, you know, if you're a data guardian, if you don't strictly need data, you need a darn good reason to implicate and to undermine intimate privacy. So if you don't have a good reason to collect data, then you just shouldn't collect it. And it would also mean a civil right to intimate privacy would also mean that the guardians, so individuals, companies, governments, would have to treat that data with a duty of loyalty to us and care and with protections against discrimination.
We're talking to Danielle Citrin, author of the new book, The Fight for Privacy, Protecting Dignity, Identity, and Love in the Digital Age. Danielle, another big focus of the book is on non-consensual pornography. It is a shorthand that covers a lot of ground. Can you talk about what that is and how prevalent it is?
Sure. So the non-consensual invasions of our intimate privacy can cover things like non-consensual taping someone in the bedroom or bathroom. It can cover extorting nude images from someone, sort of threatening to release your intimate images, upskirt down blouse photos, so taking a photo up your skirt without your permission. It can include the non-consensual disclosure of intimate information, often, as you said, well, you know, describe this as non-consensual pornography. It's sort of the best shorthand term we have for it. And in all of those ways, and many others, one's intimate images or intimate life is being invaded and violated without their permission. And when that information, often their, you know, intimate images are posted online, it can be really difficult to both get and keep a job. Your peace of mind is shot, your sense of safety. When, you know, your nude images are posted online, you often sort of think of yourself as being kind of, people see you as just a fragment of yourself. You know, you're just your genitals, you're just your, you know, breasts. And it can be really hard to have that sense of safety and security back.
And you talk to people who have been victims of various kinds of things you just mentioned. And one problem seems to be law enforcement and the law, in large part, really haven't kept up with this and offer not a lot of options to someone who's a victim.
That's right. So, you know, folks go, so I interviewed 60 people from the United States, mostly the United Kingdom, Iceland, India, and Australia. And I have to say, our response or lack of response in the United States, they're the same problems across the globe. And unfortunately, very similar sort of failure to respond from law enforcement across the globe. And it is kind of a combination of lack of training with regard to laws and the fact that so many, to the extent that law covers non-consensual intimate, you know, abusive intimate images, it's a misdemeanor. And it's just not worth law enforcement's time to do anything about it. And then you might think, okay, well, what about the platforms? You know, they're going to respond either to, you know, to lawsuits and pressure, but they're immune from responsibility thanks to Section 230 of the Decency Act. So it's victims often say to me and have said to me, they just feel like so unprotected because they turn to law enforcement and they're told nothing can be done. They even consider suing their attackers to the extent that they know who they are, and they don't have money to sue. And most lawyers aren't, you know, don't provide low bono or pro bono services for this kind of work. And there's no deep pocket. And so it's really difficult to get a lawyer to represent you on a contingency basis. You know, they would if there's a deep pocket, but not here. You know, platforms are totally immune from responsibility for the most part. And so there are 9,500 sites whose raison d'etre is intimate image abuse. And, you know, they make money from the collection of data and advertising and some subscription services. Like, they have very uncreative names like Hidden Cam and Hidden Camera or Mr. Deepfakes. And they make money off, you know, out of exploiting people's intimate, you know, the most intimate moments and exploiting them.
You share one success story in the book, getting search engines to not point toward searches toward those sites you just mentioned. Can you talk about how that happened?
Yes. It's, you know, whenever you write about something that has great frustration for most people who undergo intimate privacy violations, there are some bright stories. So I worked with then Attorney General Kamala Harris. In 2015, she put together a cyber exploitation task force. And she gathered companies together. You know, she was in Silicon Valley. And so 50 companies came together to meet to talk about the exploitation of people's nude images without their consent. And so often the complaint to AG Harris and to me was, we want these images out of searches in our names. And at the time at this meeting, you know, Google was saying, listen, we don't touch our search engine. We will, there's nothing we're going to do to our algorithms to address this problem. And after the work of the task force and Google joining that effort along with Microsoft, so Microsoft Bing, in about 6 months after, you know, as we were doing our work, Google and Bing announced, as well as Yahoo, that they would de-index non-consensual intimate image and images in searches of people's names. Now, the images would still remain online. They'd still be on those, you know, vile sites devoted to intimate image abuse. But it wouldn't be in a search of their name, so that, you know, future dates, future employers, friends, you know, so often people Google you before they ever meet you. And so it was such a relief to victims to have some sense that at least they could minimize some of the damage.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Danielle, that is one of a handful of examples where you say it's worth people fighting to make these changes because they do happen.
That's right. I mean, we have seen progress, not only with regards to law enforcers like when AG Harris, but also we've seen legislative promise in countries like South Korea, sort of wholesale reform of their laws and support for victims. So I have to say, I know I can be a bit of a Pollyanna, but I'm not giving up hope. I think, you know, if together we can pressure companies to bring our sort of moral suasion to bear, and we can work on lawmakers to make a difference.
Danielle, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That's Danielle Citrin, law professor at the University of Virginia. We talked about her new book out next week. It's called The Fight for Privacy, Protecting Dignity, Identity, and Love in the Digital Age. Now it's the Wisconsin Public Radio Fall Member Drive. Jill Nadeau joins me. You count on the Ideas Network for great conversations. It's your gift of any amount that makes these conversations possible. Listener support is the largest source of funding for WPR programs. That's why your support at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 really does make a difference.
And you remember we had that two-day challenge for 500 people, and if they contributed, we were getting an additional $25,000. Remember that, Rob?
I do. I have a vague memory of talking
you
about
do.
That. Yeah.
Great long-term memory. Well, we are so excited to announce that the $25,000 challenge was met.
Oh, fantastic.
Isn't that wonderful?
That
well, thank you so much to more than 500 people who joined in to meet that special two-day challenge. And this is just wonderful news because listener support, your support, is the largest source of funding for the WPR programs that you rely on.
If you missed your chance to get in on that challenge, still time, you can add in and get us up over 500 and just blow past this challenge. Make your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Just had a interesting, I think really important conversation about our data, our personal information, our images, for that matter, how vulnerable they are in the online world, even if we don't really go online all that often, and some hope from our guest that, yes, things can be better. It's an example of the kind of conversation with problems and possible solutions we bring you all the time on Central Time.
It was a wonderful conversation, Rob, and some in such important information that we may not even think about sometimes. And it all comes to pass because WPR is listener supported, and that means that your donation at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 makes the many topics you tune in for every day possible. So choose an amount that works for you, then make your gift.
I have a husband and three sons, and we're all very avid listeners. We feel that Wisconsin Public Radio provides objective and informative information about what's going on in the community. It certainly is a station where you can call in, and you know that for sure that if you have an opposing viewpoint, that it's going to be broadcast because this is public radio. I'm Joan Rudnitsky, and Wisconsin Public Radio is my source for objective information and entertainment.
Make your gift of support for Wisconsin Public Radio right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Central Time, the Fall Member Drive, Rob Ferret here with Jill Nadeau. The WPR programs you enjoy are possible thanks to your support. Your gift of $10 a month or $100 a month, you pick the amount. Either way, it makes a big difference.
Your gift right now says, I value this program. I want more of it. It makes me think. It makes me laugh. Well, you fill in the blank with how you feel when you hear this show. Those are powerful feelings. And you make a powerful statement when you support what you value, what you believe in. So give now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
The programs you hear on WPR make a difference in your life. That's why you're listening right now. Why you listen maybe every day. During the Fall Member Drive, we're asking you to support your radio home.
Listeners who value public radio give what they can to support it, and that's how it works. If you're already a member, well, thank you for making Wisconsin Public Radio possible. If you're not a member yet, today's the day to become one. So make your first ever gift. Maybe it's just $100. Well, maybe it's $10 a month. Well, give any amount that's right for you at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Support the great conversations you count on online at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552, and thank you.